Hello and welcome to a KBOO News and Public Affairs special program, Focus on Palestine-Israel. I'm your host, William Seaman. Today we have a presentation by 11-term Israeli Knesset member Naomi Chazan. Ms. Chazan spoke at the opening session for a recent conference held in the city of Ramallah in the Palestine territories. The conference, titled Ending the Occupation and Siege, The Need for a New Coalition, was held January 5th through the 7th, 2007. And now, Ms. Naomi Chazan.
I want to start with three introductory comments so to explain what I'm going to do. Number one, I was asked to give a political analysis. So I want you to understand that there's a difference between an analysis and my opinion. Bear with me, please. It's not easy to do a political analysis. That's number one. Number two, I was instructed to find some rays of light. And I haven't slept all night searching for them, but I've got a few, and you have to hear them, because nobody will forgive me among the organizers if I do not at least indicate some rays of light. That's number two. And number three, because I have a lot of ground to cover, I will speak almost telegraphically, but at least I will speak in a structured manner. Okay, what I intend to do is a political analysis of the Israeli political scene today and what the possibilities and prospects are. And I will start with a dilemma, which is the dilemma of the activist and not of the analyst. On the one hand, anybody who examines the situation today within Israel almost must come to the conclusion that the situation is stuck. And I will explain why in a few minutes. On the other hand, anybody who is an activist has the expectation that there is a possibility of bringing about real change in the situation. And therefore, the dilemma is, how do we reconcile the analysis with the expectation? I think that's the reason why we're here today. And I have the miserable job, I highlight the miserable job of doing the analysis and maybe pointing to some areas where there's a little bit of at least flexibility or perhaps fluidity. My main contention is, and I agree entirely with Jad on this point, that we have to look for different ways of putting the puzzle together by injecting new forces into the equation. Because if one expects the officials to bring about some kind of accord, we might as well retire. Okay? Let me move in to the analysis of the Israeli political situation. And there are two key features, which I will describe at some length. The first feature is that the Israeli political system today suffers more than at any moment in the past from a situation of instability and basic dysfunction. Anybody looking at what's going on in Israel cannot be but impressed by the fact that the situation is in extreme distress. The political system is in extreme distress. And I'll just highlight some of the features of this distress. Number one, as the Lebanese war indicated, decision-making procedures are thoroughly inadequate. That's a polite way of saying they're not working. And again, Lebanon is a good example, but it is unclear to anybody who examines the system closely how decisions are being made, by whom, and why. Number two, there is a serious leadership crisis. Ehud Olmert maybe has 10, 12, 13% approval ratings. Amir Peretz is about 3%. Single-digit approval ratings in any country that claims to be a democracy is unheard of. But nevertheless, the crisis is amazing. They are inexperienced and they are not respected. Number three, corruption is eating away at the heart of the Israeli political system. Just this week, there were another series of scandals, and they reached the very top. But do not be fooled. They also go very much to the bottom as well. So that's a third problem. Number four, there is no political agenda of the present government. Unilateralism after Lebanon is dead, and it has not been replaced by anything else. Number five, the military, which will surprise some people in this room, the military is suffering from a real blow to its deterrent power and public image. There is a general's war going on at the moment beneath the surface. It may have quietened down a bit this week. My estimation is it will revive within the next 2 months with the publication of the Winograd Commission report. And finally, six, most Israelis are disaffected, if not alienated, from the political system. Look, take these six features together. It is surprising that the government is standing. Really, put it together. It is a textbook perfect picture of a non-functional government. And most of the Israelis sitting here today would add more to my list. And I will embrace whatever you say. That's the first feature. The second feature of the political situation today, and it is a contradictory feature, is that there is no indication of any kind of change taking place in the foreseeable future. I would say that the system is paralyzed. It is immobile. Now, I want you to follow this analysis because depending on whether you agree with it or not, it closes or opens options. But I want to at least list the reasons why the prospects for change at the moment, in next year or two, are probably very limited indeed. Number one is a very formalistic structural reason. After Lebanon and the addition of Lieberman to the coalition, the coalition numbers 78 members. It passed the budget, a terrible budget, this week, very easily. And it shows no signs of anything besides minor crises, which one is used to in Israeli politics. So reason number one why the system is paralyzed is the coalition is very stable indeed. Number two, the Labour Party has become totally unraveled. It is almost impossible for people like myself to explain why the Labour Party stayed in the government with the addition of Lieberman. It is a complete surrender of basic principles of the party, but nevertheless, it is there. The only one who will maybe get some votes out of it is Ophir Pines. More importantly, Labour is going to be involved for the Intel May now with its internal primaries, which will have nothing to do with the future leadership of the country and everything to do with who the next defense minister is going to be. So the Labour Party, which is perhaps the source of this of opposition, doesn't exist, and it is not left by any stretch of the imagination. Number three, the so-called peace camp in Israel is more split today than ever before. What happened during Lebanon, and most of you know where I'm coming from, was a situation where even Meretz, the majority of Meretz, supported the war for the first 3 years, creating a split.
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Probably years is correct, too. Three weeks. Okay? A real split, which is a substantive split, is taking place in the peace camp. The two sides of the so-called peace camp are finding very little common ground, very little common activity. The situation is very, very difficult within the peace camp itself. Number four, and this is sad but true, the more sophisticated those who want change are, the more willing they are to accept the present situation because they fear the alternatives. If there were elections tomorrow, the choice would be Bibi or Lieberman. So they accept what exists, which is unacceptable, because they assume that the alternative is weak. Number five is perhaps the most important point, because it's a real challenge also for change, and that is many Israelis have exited the system, not physically, but mentally and actively. After this war, the Lebanon war, this summer, one would have expected so much protest. It was an awful, awful war. But instead of hearing protest, the voice, what one sees within Israel today is the perfection, I would argue very strongly, of exit, okay, of escapism as a way of life. And when many of the people that have been active in the past are busy finding spiritual meaning, the soldiers of the peace force are simply not there. And finally, if you put all this together, the sources of change within Israel are paralyzed. There is a fear of talking, there are naysayers, or there are escape artists. Now, let us combine these two features.
What about the line?
It's coming, but I have another 10 minutes. I really would like to put the two pieces together. Because on the one hand, instability is usually an inducement to change. And on the other hand, the sources of change are not functional. If you put these two pieces together, I think it is very easy to explain. The Olmert gestures, government gestures at this moment, ceasefire, maybe an exchange of prisoners. Genjad, thank you very much. A little bit of removal of one checkpoint here to put up three there, etc. In other words, very small movement and an entirely focused attention on very concrete, very immediate interim measures with no policy approach whatsoever. And the second point, which is difficult for me to mention today after yesterday, but it's very important, there is no formal government policy or strategy in the occupied Palestinian territories. The day-to-day policy is being carried out by the military, often without governmental knowledge or approval. And that helps to explain the bizarre timing of certain events.
Yes,
in other words, and Chagit challenged me, this is the bleakest side, the outcome of the picture I depicted. So let's discuss the strategic issues that face us and where there are maybe some points that we have to pay attention to. Okay, the first strategic question is, how far is this government capable of going? This government being the Olmert government. Are there any places where there is some kind of fluidity? And the truth is, I found some. I want to offer them to you because I think they're the basis for discussion. Okay? Number one, public opinion today is very supportive of negotiations. Majority supportive of negotiations, both with the Palestinians and with Syria. Over 50% consistently in the last 6 months. And by the way, as a politician, let me say that if I were reading the polls and I were heading the government, I would go for it. I have over 50% support. So that's a ray of life, of light, which combines with several other signs that we're seeing. There is clearly a split today between Ehud Olmert and Tzipi Livni. And Tzipi Livni is pushing a line of negotiations, not only publicly, but practically. She has been involved in behind the scenes discussions with several Palestinian leaders. I'm not sure how wide the scope is, but nevertheless, it exists. And she finally, a week ago, came out with a direct challenge to Ehud Olmert, indicating that she sees herself as a prime ministerial candidate. So a second place where there is a little bit of fluidity is the very intriguing tension between Livni and Olmert in the government. A third area where there is interesting possibilities is that after Lebanon, Israel removed its principled objection in the past to the positioning of international forces in the area. Do not underestimate that. Israel has refused to accept international forces in the past. In the context of 1701, it asks for them. The question is whether that internationalization is transferable from the north to the Gaza and 67 boundaries. Interesting question. Some place for maybe a little activity. In the same vein, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has always been regionalized, but it's not much more regionalized today than it was in the past. And there is at least an expansion of the thinking of how to deal with the conflict within the regional context. It explains even bad meetings with Mubarak and feelers with Lebanese and Syrian, at least semi-officials. I found one statement that's repeated itself particularly interesting in the regional context, and that is the official reiteration of Israeli interest in the Arab League initiative of March 2002. Right. Interesting. At least something to play with. And finally, and the truth of the matter is, I had agreed with Akiva Eldar that he would do this. So I will just make one very clear statement about the United States, and if we want, we can discuss it. After the Baker-Hamilton report, the American midterm elections, okay, the question is, how much can Israel move independently of the United States? And I think there is some, at least, interesting questions that are coming up in his official Israeli circles, some of them indicating a preference to move now over later. So that's also a possibility.
In other 10 minutes.
I have 10 minutes. Oh, I don't need them. I'm going telegraphically. And finally, a very important elusive factor that provides, injects some flexibility is the amazing sense of urgency that is being felt by everybody. People understand that if something is done, not done now, it won't happen. In other words, the time is really running out. All you have to do is look at the maps. But time is running out, and the urgency is actually a very significant prompter for some kind of action. So, how far can this government go? This government go, because that was the first strategic question. If I take into account these factors and others that you'll add, I would say I wouldn't be surprised if there were a mini international conference in the next 6 months with American prompting. Yes, a mini. The only problem is, to be quite honest, I have no idea what will be on the agenda. Okay? The substance is unclear. But I think it's important for us to understand that some of the trends actually lead to this kind of conclusion, and one has to put it in context. Let me move to the second strategic question. And the second strategic question is the one that really interests, frankly, me as an activist, not as an analyst, but I think the people in this room this morning. Second strategic question, it's the question oppositions, in the plural, must put forward. Second strategic question is, how can we get leaders who don't want to move in the direction we want them to go? Okay, and I will repeat the question because it is critical. If you don't like the answers, fine, my answers. Don't forget the question. The question is, how can the governments be pushed against their will to do the right thing? That's the question. Okay? Now, on that question, where, after the sorry state at least of the Israeli political opposition, are points for fluidity? I find 2 points. At the moment, I would love to find more. The first is that I think civil society groups now understand better than in the past that it is not good enough to deal only with human rights. There has to be political action. Okay? That realization is very important. not all groups, some groups have always been political, because right in the front row is Uri Avneri, and who better has done that over the years than Uri, okay? But I think there's a greater realization of a lot of groups that they have to add a political dimension to their action. That's number one. And the second point is the objectives are much clearer. We are talking about two states, 67 boundaries, two capitals for two states, in Jerusalem, removal of settlements. Okay, I'm saying you can, in the middle of the night, wake up anybody here and say, if you're talking about a political process, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's the objective is clear. There's no any kind of equivocation on that. More important, there is agreement on the procedure. No to further interim steps or any phased approach. Negotiations on permanent settlement now. Okay? Or else all the other alternatives, one-state solutions of various sorts, kick in. I mean, I'm talking about a political process. And the third point is absolutely no patience with preconditions of any sort, of any kind, of preconditions of any sort, of any kind. Now, the question then is, how do you play with this? And I would suggest that we have to add mechanisms to those that have been in operation. Recently, I have a model, which is the International Women's Commission for a Just and Sustainable Palestinian-Israeli Peace, which I think we'll hear about more this afternoon, hopefully. But I suggest at least four elements, and then I'll stop. Okay, we have to expand the actors. If it's up to officials, nothing will happen. And therefore, there has to be a closer linkage to the activity of civil society and decision makers, which requires civil society to swallow hard and address decision makers, something not easy to do. That's number one. Number two, I think it's necessary to change some of the ways that we've been acting, because a lot of Palestinian-Israeli activity has been parallel activity and not joint activity, okay? And without a coalition of forces, it's not going to work. The strongest prospects lie in a coalition of forces within each society, not easy, but working together. Because if there's not a strong voice and a consistent voice, it's easy to split those who still believe apart. So that's the second, perhaps, element. Third element is we must alter the scope of the activities. Israeli-Palestinian without international today is meaningless. I think there are three components and not two in the equation, and I would suggest also bringing in the international. And finally, I think we have to find a way of working on humanitarian issues and making them political, and working on political issues and making them humanitarian. Instead of dividing between the two, we need some way of bringing them together, because we need a tangible, immediate improvement in order to create the dynamic and the momentum for change. So we have to assume responsibility. And I am finished, not to worry. If you make a political analysis at one level, we are stuck. If you start asking strategic questions, you will see points of possibility, both in terms of what the governments can do and in terms of what oppositions can do. And if we are able to move things forward, we should do so quickly, and thank you for your patience.